I'm sorry, we don't have time for the introduction stuff today. We need to jump right in. Welcome, School for Startups Radio. Really appreciate you being here. Thank you so much. Two great guests today. Stuart Draper talking about a whole bunch of great stuff. He has a Startups with Stu. And then we have Sue Inches to talk about environment advocates. Here we go. Very excited to introduce another great guest. Please welcome Stuart Draper to the show. He is host of Startups with Stu, a podcast for aspiring entrepreneurs who want to learn what it takes to get started. He has been incredibly successful. He's been on the Inc. 5000 list 10 times, 7 times with Stu Kent. Is that how you pronounce it? Stu Kent?
Yes.
It is a ed tech platform for 1 million educators and students. And that was on the list 7 times. Then 3 times he was on the Inc. 5000 list for Get Found First, which was acquired very successfully. He is author of Digital Marketing Essentials, which is a best-selling text on digital marketing. And he's a father of 4 munchkins. Stu, welcome. How you doing?
I'm doing so well. Thanks for having me on the show.
It is our pleasure. So why don't you go back to the beginning? Tell us about Stu Kent and how it got started and the services offered. It sounds really interesting.
So Stu Kent is a company that came to my mind as an idea first when I was teaching as an adjunct faculty member. I was asked to go back to my alma mater, and I was just so disappointed by the curriculum that there was to work with. So I started talking to other universities and asking them how they were teaching the subject of digital marketing, and everyone was disappointed. No one was happy with their approach. And it was kind of one of those, there's got to be a better way, aha moments that a lot of founders have, led to, this idea of creating an up-to-date textbook and a simulation that would give students a hands-on learning experience. And we now call those simulations simternships, a simulated internship. And so as the student is reading and studying, they also have the opportunity to put into practice via simulation what they're learning about in the text. And it really brings to life the material and gives them motivation to need the information now to perform well in the simulation. So, Stu Kent is my pride and joy and biggest win. I ran it from 2013 until 2023 as the CEO. And then in January 2024, we brought on a new CEO, and I am now just on the board. There's 165 of them working every day on making education better throughout the world. And I've loved to have been the pioneer for all of that.
Excellent. Go back in time and tell us how you got started. I know that you had a Christmas light company. I love Christmas lights myself. And so that was really entertaining to me. Talk to us about how you worked your way up to becoming an adjunct. How'd you get invited to be an adjunct professor? That's fairly impressive. And how'd you get your career started and get to the point of being a standout?
Jim, I love that you said, how did you build into that? Because it doesn't just all happen at once. I mean, the opportunities built on each other. In college, I stunk at used car sales as a side job while I was in college. I stunk at summer sales, knocking doors door to door. But those things, although they were hard and I didn't succeed, they built me. And then I got my internship and my first job out of college doing Google Ads. That was the one skill that my university really gave me that I hadn't picked, that I think gave me an edge up in the world back in 2008. And because of those experiences, I was more prepared for what came next, which was I'm selling digital marketing services in my first job out of college. It's going well. And then one day they pull us all in a room and said, hey, you're all laid off. We don't have a way to pay the bills. The funding that we thought was going to come through, the investors backed out because this was 08 and the market had crashed. And man, that was a hard day to go home to my wife with our second baby on the way and say, hey, I'm out of a job again. She was with me when I stunk at used car sales. She was with me when I stunk at door-to-door sales. She was now with me when I was actually selling really well. And it was a good confidence booster for me that I had been the leader, best sales rep on the team, and then pulled in a room and laid off. Well, luckily, I had learned the basics of how to sell digital marketing services, and I actually knew how to provide the services myself. So after a third failed job with someone else, I decided, you know what? I've always wanted to be an entrepreneur. My brother-in-law, I was helping him with his Google ads for fun, for free on the side. He's a dentist in Salem, Oregon. His website had 3 breaking months of new patients from the work I was doing. And so rather than look for another job, I started helping dentists with their Google ads and using my brother-in-law as my first testimonial. And I bootstrapped getfoundfirst.com as a young CEO. Like, I just fell into entrepreneurship way younger than I expected. I kind of always dreamt of being an entrepreneur, like I did in college. One of the other little wins I had was running the Christmas light company. That was just like a 3-month long business. But what it did was it gave me confidence that I knew what it took to get a customer, treat the customer well, have them pay me for my services. And so it was that type of little startup is something I highly recommend an aspiring entrepreneur try out. Some sort of service-based business, little barrier to entry, and easy to get some quick wins. I think that's a really wise approach. So yeah, that was how I came into entrepreneurship and kind of how things built.
Very cool. I love that. And so now, is digital ads still your number one revenue source?
So getfoundfirst.com, that agency I started, I ran that from 2008 until 2011 as the managing partner and guy in charge. Then in 2012 and 2013, I took a different role, and I actually went and worked for the man for a couple of years. While I was doing that, I still was the majority owner of getfoundfirst.com. And I'm so glad I held on to that business and that ownership at that time, because it's what allowed me to quit working for the man again and start StuKent, the education technology company that I started. And in 2015, 2 years after starting StuKent, StuKent was off to the races. We went from 100 grand in year one to 500 grand in year two. I knew that a million was possible in year three. And so I decided to go to my managing partner and say, hey, we're going to sell getfoundfirst.com. So in 2015, I had my first exit from a startup that I started. And the new owners of getfoundfirst.com still run it today. And it's been now 10 years. I can't believe it's already been 10 years, but they have continued to go and grow and do so well with that brand that I created. And it's fun to see that a business I built is still employing, I think they're at like 50 employees in that business, and it's going and growing well. And so I don't make money off of digital ads anymore myself, other than I use my digital ad skill set and in other ventures and other things that I'm working on now, like my podcast, Startups with Stu.
All right. We do want to talk about that in a minute, but I want to go to your mission statement first. It says you're on a mission to create 1,000 plus millionaires, which would make that group worth $1 billion, right? 1,000 times.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Tell us about that mission. Is that part of what drives the podcast?
Yeah, exactly. So to help 1,000 people become millionaires individually, one at a time, is very difficult. Not impossible. That's a lot of investments. It's a lot of mentorship calls, a lot of time spent training and teaching and helping and connecting and networking. It's so many things. But what I want to be able to do is, when I'm old and in a rocking chair, I want to look back and go, look at all these people that point at me as a key instrument and help in them becoming a millionaire. They go, oh, I started subscribing to the Startups with Stu show. And then I went to one of his retreats and I met him in person and he connected me to so-and-so. And that's all I needed from him. But man, it was so instrumental. That's what I'm looking to do now. And I've done 4 retreats with about 20 to 40 people at each retreat. I've brought in some really cool speakers and it's been fun to connect people. But yeah, that mission is something that means a lot to me. Here's why. I believe that founders and entrepreneurs are what make America great again. We need more builders, people that are creating and innovating. And this is the best time our world's ever seen to start a business with all of the new technology that's come out with AI. The sky is the limit with the new businesses that will be created. And I want to be a part of motivating people that they can do it. That they should try their hand at it. So many people that generate wealth like I have, StuCan's now worth it's a 9-figure business. And I'm proud of that. But I don't say that to brag. I say that to say, when people like me have a payday like I've had, most of them get safe with their investments and they go into the stock market and they go into real estate. And those are fine investments with a part of your portfolio. But I think every founder that has a big exit and payday needs to put some of their money back in founders. And so that's a big part of my life mission now, is helping others get going. And I know that if they go and grow, they're going to create new jobs for other people and everyone's winning.
So do you have a philosophy on the show or pedagogy or what does the show promote that makes that system different from all the others that are trying to help people become entrepreneurs? What's the sauce there?
That's a great question. Most of the entrepreneur shows that I've listened to, they spend almost all of their time with the people that have already been there and done that and have a cool story and big exit to share, which is fine. And there's a place for that. And my show includes guests like that. But I also have guests on the show that are aspiring founders, that are failed founders looking for direction on what they should try next. And people that are just gaining traction that haven't had an exit, but want to figure out what that's like. And so it's a mix of, it's not just listening to people who've already made it, but people that are in the grind and getting advice from me. And now you can listen to me give advice to other founders and in turn apply that to your own startup.
How many shows have you done and all of those metrics?
We're up at 47 shows now. It's been really fun to grow the show and, I've helped and touched over 150,000 now with it, as far as listens and downloads. So I'm really happy with the success we've had so far, but really driven to go and take it to the next level too.
Yes, that is what drives everybody. I mean, no matter how big, we still want to make things bigger. There was a famous line in, maybe it was Disclosure, a movie with Demi Moore and Michael Douglas and Donald Sutherland. And Donald Sutherland was the 500 millionaire or something like that. And Demi Moore says, wow, you give a man $100 million and all he can do is dream of becoming a billionaire, you know, because $100 million should set you for life. You know, you're good. Yep. You know, you don't need anything after that. But why become a billionaire after that? Because of male ego and drive to kill more animals? What do you think? What would you do if you had $100 million exit and could fund every charity you wanted and all of the kids were set for life? You'd still keep working, right, Stuart?
You know, that's a great question. And I think for everyone, it's a little different. You have to do a lot of soul searching. One of my favorite things to do when I sit down for lunch with people, and I challenge you to try this as well if you haven't, but just say, okay, tomorrow you have $10 million. What are you going to do with it? When I started realizing StuCan was going to go and grow and maybe I'd have that $10 million plus payday, I started asking people that question, not telling them that was going to happen to me, but because I wanted to think about it a lot and understand, like, how would you use it? What would you do with it? And so frequently it's like, oh, I'd put my money in stocks. I'd buy my mom a house. I'd pay off my loans and pay off my house. You know, that a lot of that type of thinking. But when I met with people that have been there and done that, they talked about it very differently. It was all about, well, I will go and build this. I will go and help others build that. Like, it was about building and growing instead of just about settling. And so I think the people that are builders that have these paydays, they're driven by building and having more influence more than they're about just more money. Yeah, it's a really soul searching question, and I think for everyone a little different as to what the answer is.
Why do you think the podcast committee decided that you should have a podcast? And when they called you and told you, "Oh, hey, Stuart, you got approved. You're allowed to have a podcast." What do you think their thinking was behind that decision?
So this was a committee decision of one. I'm a founder.
Approved by the committee.
So I'm an investor, and I invested in a startup called PodUp, podup.com and PODUP.com. And so I'm using their technology. And that was a key motivator for me as the chair of the board for that startup. I wanted to try and use their technology and eat the dog food, you know, my own dog food here in this case. And that's been a really rewarding part of the experience. But as far as like,
what does that business do, Stuart? Before you go on, tell us about what it does.
Yeah, it is a one-stop shop. They're trying to be the shop, what Shopify did to the world of e-commerce. They're trying to do that for podcasting. Riverside would be a closest competitor, but they're trying to do a lot of additional business building technology and use the podcasting technology as a piece of that bigger picture of building a business, with the belief that podcasting should be a part of everyone's marketing mix now.
Oh, I definitely believe that 100%.
Well, as I've built my podcast, I've been blown away by what it's done for my network. And I'm sure, Jim, you've seen that, you've experienced that too. And I look back at my last startup and I go, man, I could have had a podcast where I had a different professor on the show every day. And think about what that would have done to expand the reach and knowledge of our brand if I had constantly been getting these, you know, very willing professors that love to share their research. They love, and they just need outlets to share. And we could have been giving them that. We did that via webinar, but we didn't via podcast. And I'm not the CEO anymore, so that's not my strategic decision to start something like that. But man, what a powerful tool it can be.
Yes. Well, you can still start that business or that podcast, it seems like. I find that the best way to use a podcast still, when you suggest it to people, is still shocking idea to them. Even people that have a podcast, when I say, you should have a podcast with your 50 dream customers, and those are your 50 guests for the year. Mm-hmm. They're like, oh, you know, I mean, it's a pretty basic idea there. You know, a great way to introduce yourself to your dream client list or dream anything list is to have a podcast. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, if you want to become an interesting guy in high school, have a high school podcast and have cool kids interviewed every week. And pretty soon you'd be a cool kid, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%.
I have to get one of my kids to try that. A
podcast
about the 11th grade.
I love it. I'm going to challenge my 16-year-old daughter to do the same right after this show, actually. Now that you mention it, it's going to be awesome.
It would have to be always upbeat, though. You know, it would have to, it's important that the tone is
positive.
Like, I was explaining it to someone the other day and they were kind of shocked. I have never, Stuart, had a bad guest. Every guest I have is the best guest ever.
I love it.
And they were like, I've never single had a bad guest. Well, I could actually think of two, but I always say that the last guest I had is my best guest ever. So
I'm glad I get to carry that torch for a little while then. Thank you.
Have the sixth grade or the 16-year-old 11th grade podcast. It has to be positive. It can't be snarky because that would get in trouble and create enemies and stuff.
Yep, exactly.
So,
well, Jim, I'm so excited for my favorite part of your show, which is the Quick 10 game.
Oh, you want to play?
Can we do it?
Let's go right now. Number one, your favorite creativity. Oh, I forgot. Do you want to accept the wager?
Oh, what's the wager?
The standard bet that everyone else makes.
Which is?
You know, the bet on the outcome that everyone else does.
I've got the bet. I'm in.
There you go. Number one, your favorite creativity hack.
Favorite creativity hack. Get outside. Adventure is where I have found that I get the most creative.
Number two, favorite bootstrapping trick.
Oh, man. Utilize your network. You have to go to friends and family first and connect that way.
Number three, name your top passions.
Oh, my wife, my kids, my faith, my hobby of boating, and my hobby of baseball.
Number four, the first three steps in starting a business are?
Sales first, then figuring out the type of entity to create. And then, geez, I guess it goes product, sales, and then legal in that order.
Number five, the best way to get your first real customer is?
Best way to get your first real customer is... ask. Too many people are afraid to ask.
Number six, your dreamiest technology is?
Claude AI. I am absolutely in love with what Claude can do for me.
Number eight, worst entrepreneurial mistake.
Worst entrepreneurial mistake is a partnership without contract.
Number nine, favorite entrepreneur and why?
Elon Musk, because he does not need to be one, but he's changing the world by continuing to have influence versus sitting back and relaxing on a beach.
Number 10, favorite superhero.
My favorite superhero are my parents. I'm giving a two for one there. My parents are my superhero.
Fantastic. While we calculate the answer or the score, how do we get in touch with you? Find out more.
So if you search up Startups with Stu, you will find me. My name is Stuart Draper. I'm on LinkedIn if you want to search up that way, but Startups with Stu, go find that on Google. You'll find the podcast, you'll find my website, all that good stuff.
Fantastic. I'm just kind of pausing until, Stuart, I am so bummed. Oh, this is devastating. You got a 94. 94 is an excellent score, but you have to have a 95 to win the wager. Apparently, we had a judge from Wisconsin that doesn't like people from Idaho or something. So I don't know what that's about. But anyway, we always play for a Tesla. So thank you for that. I'll look forward to receiving one in the mail soon.
Hey, 94 out of 100 is an A. I'll take the A. I'm an A student. Well, so there we go.
Great answers. Why is Claude so much better than other AIs? Pitch Claude to me.
Oh, the thing that I love about Claude is that it is such a good language learning model. The actual text that it writes back is written in such good English that makes perfect sense to me. And then I've been able to my favorite thing to do with it is to run a business idea through it. So if I'm considering investing in a business or if I'm considering starting a business, I just walk through every last question, and it does such a good job of not just giving me the answer, but then thinking ahead of time about the next questions it needs to be asking me and get to the best possible final business plan. And I recommend it for every new founder. No founder should ever start a business after 2024 without using an AI to help you think it through. So
great suggestion. Stuart, thank you so much for being with us. Startups with Stu. Thanks a lot, Stu. We love to have you back.
Jim Beach, thanks. You're the man. Appreciate you.
And we will be right back. are back, and again, still very appreciative that you are with us. You know, I published that book on the environment, and I'm still begging all of you to buy it. And in the process, I ran across some people that I wanted to meet and find out more about. And our next guest is one of those. Please welcome Sue Inches to the show. She is author of a book called Advocating for the Environment, How to Gather Your Power and Take Action. Her entire career has been devoted to the environment, 25 years in public policy. She is currently the Deputy Director of Maine State Planning Office, where she's in charge of issues for the governor in the environmental space. Prior to that, she was Director of Maine Department of Marine Resources, taking care of the fishes and stuff. I've actually sailed in that area, and it's some of the most beautiful places in the world. Bar Harbor is one of the most beautiful places in the world to sail into. So just gorgeous where she is working. In 2018, she put together a college class teaching environmental advocacy. And I have to say, this is the reason I'm excited for this interview. I've had so many questions when I'm doing, you know, promoting my book, and people say, well, what do I do to help? And I always flub that question. That class is available at both Colby and Bates. And just to let you know, Sue, I was accepted to Colby, but went to Middlebury instead. Sue Inches, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
Great. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I can't wait to get your take on this. Before this, before we talk about your book, did you hear what Bill Gates said the other day?
I absolutely did. In fact, I've already written, although I haven't released it, a blog post about my take on that.
Care to share a synopsis?
Gosh, it's a complicated question, but basically, Bill Gates is trying to narrow the issue of climate change down to poverty and disease. And of course, poverty and disease are part of that issue, but the way I see it, climate issues are actually larger than that, and we do need to reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. We do need to create a just transition to renewable energy. There's a lot to it. I mean, climate's a complex, what I call a systemic issue, and I thought that Gates had tried to narrow it down a bit much. And even though I appreciate much of the good work that Bill Gates has done, I mean, his foundation has funded a lot of good medical work in developing countries, and there's a lot of good that Bill Gates has done. But I think that his memo to the Brazil climate conference that starts in about a week and a half is a little bit narrower than they're going to be seeing this issue.
Very interesting response. So absolutely fascinating. You know, Sue, I just wrote my book on the people who I find currently solving a lot of the environmental problems are the entrepreneurs. And I found 216 American entrepreneurs that are currently for-profit companies that are solving an environmental problem. And they're just so cool. I was blown away by how diverse they are. One of them that I encountered was a European company. I don't remember the name, and I should have prepared better because I didn't anticipate talking about this, but one of those companies is making huge strides in cleaning the air and making the air issue go away. And Bill Gates is their largest investor there. And I contacted the company and asked for an interview, and they just flat out refused to even talk to me. And it's all the components of a James Bond movie, Sue, right there. A secretive billionaire, you know, I don't know, just... I was really disappointed they wouldn't even talk to me and brag about what the cool stuff they're doing.
That's a surprise to me, actually, because there's so many great innovative companies, and most of them are eager to talk about their work. So I don't know. I do not know the details of this, but usually that's what you want to hear is people's success stories and what they're doing. That's really good.
Yeah. And so Bill upset me there. I don't understand what's going on. I'm going to keep an eye on that company just out of curiosity. So out of our current billionaires, Sue, who do you think would make the best James Bond villain?
I don't know.
I think Zuckerberg with his secret lair in Hawaii, something like 30,000 square feet underground. That's the making of a James Bond villain right there.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think there's good actors and bad actors. And, I watched a documentary last night about basically hedge fund people that are have gutted, thousands of newspapers, taking their assets and selling them off and firing all the people. So I think, there are a lot.
Horrible.
There's a lots of things to investigate. People come in all stripes, and you have got your good investors and your bad ones.
Yes, very well said. All right. What can we as individual non-billionaire type people do to make the environment better? So let's talk a little bit about the book, please.
Well, sure, absolutely. So one of the things interesting to me about the book is that I originally wrote it as a text for my college classes. And then I went out on the road as a sort of an author tour. You go out, you speak to a lot of different groups. And I did that. And what I realized is that ordinary people need to be empowered as advocates. And I also noticed that a lot of people are scared of the word advocacy. It's kind of a big, long, multiple syllable word. And so what I think is that we have to sort of take back our power. And advocacy is all about telling your story, right? So if you have a story about something near where you live, maybe it's a river or it's a coastline or it's a forest, whatever it is, you need to talk about why you care about these things with the people who make decisions about them. So that's really the first thing, is that citizens need to figure out kind of what they care about and then talk to decision makers. And when I say decision makers, that could be anyone from your homeowners association board to your state legislature to Congress. I mean, they're all different levels, but advocacy needs to be taking place at all levels. And it's up to us citizens to do that, because if we don't tell our stories, then things that we love won't be protected. So when you boil it all down, it's pretty simple. It's what you care about and telling the people who have the power to make decisions why you care about it. So that's kind of the bottom line.
All right. What do we do when internally we disagree? So for example, there was some survey data that came out about a week or two ago, and it had for the first time a majority of Democrats supporting nuclear power as part of our solution, as just how do we get clean energy, renewable, and all of that. A lot of Democrats still hate nuclear. What are your thoughts on these issues that still divide the team?
Well, yeah, so that's a case where, we need to bring out the full story. So, nuclear power, and I'm talking about fission here, not fusion, but nuclear power has its pluses and minuses, right? So it can produce electricity without fossil fuel emissions, obviously, because it's not fossil fuels. But we have never solved the problem about what to do with the nuclear waste. And so we have here in Maine, where I live, there is nuclear waste from a closed down nuclear power plant that's still sitting there. It's in a concrete vault covered with water, but it's sitting there, and there are people who live near it, right? So this is where you want to have the people that live near it talk about the risk they have of contamination or something bad happening. And kind of, I mean, it doesn't move an issue forward to ignore some part of it. And in this case with nuclear, I think we probably have ignored the waste problem for years and years. And so in order to—
Can I interject real fast, Sue?
Yeah, sure.
The small modular reactors, the fourth generation reactors—
Yep.
Supposedly, from what I understand, you can take their waste and put it back into the system, and they're getting to the point now where they're producing spoonfuls of waste over years. So, it's still not perfect, but it's the amount of waste is still not, you know, like the cavernous things in Utah they're building to bury it underground that's the size of 800 football fields, you know?
Right.
I don't think we're going to need that as much. We still got all the junk to clean up from the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, though. I still acknowledge that. So back to you.
Yeah. No, that's true. I think the technology is absolutely improving. The other thing that has to improve, of course, is our understanding and actual skill at building these, because, you know, we did have the first nuclear powered fission plant in this country that had been built in years and decades was built in Georgia. And it was way over budget and way over the amount of time it was supposed to take to build it. So we have a learning.
Only $10 billion over budget, Sue. Come on.
Right.
I'm one of the Georgia Power customers that's glad to pay that extra $500 a year.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we kind of have a learning curve. If we're going to go this way, we have a lot to learn about how to do it and how to do it cost effectively and in a relatively reasonable amount of time. So that's just kind of where we are.
Yeah, again, the SMR-4s are built in a factory, and so that's a huge game changer on an assembly line. And so if that can happen, I'd much rather weld indoors than outdoors in the Georgia heat, you know, and stuff. So I hope that the fourth generation are as big a change as they say. Also, the coolant is sodium-based now as opposed to water-based, so they don't have to have the endless supply of water, you know, the river, or there's always a big water supply right next to the power plant. So
Right. Yeah. I mean, and what you're pointing out really is that, there has been so much great progress in innovation. I mean, it was interesting because I'm not really a technology person, but I thought to myself, why did we never think about manufacturing or pre-manufacturing, you know, nuclear power plant components before? I mean, why were we building all these plants like custom when we could have, like, you know, made it much more efficient and you know, build parts in a factory like we do with other, you know? So it took a while for this innovation to kind of, come into being. But that's, you know, it's great to see that.
Well, you know, it had to fit in with the environment and stuff. The architecture had to, you know, fit in.
Yeah. So
each one had to be custom,
I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
That's the dumbest idea I can think of, that they
had
to blend in with the other power plants nearby. So.
Oh, and look ugly and take up a lot of space. You mean? Yeah. Right.
What are the biggest issues that Maine is dealing with right now? I have to think that fisheries are way high on the list. What are you dealing with now? What are the things that are concerning you and the governor?
Well, I think actually a lot of it is toxics in the environment. So just like everywhere else, we get tons of plastic and the packaging, you know, products come in a package that's within a package within a package, and the materials that are used are often not recyclable. So really there's a whole lot of discussion right now. And we were the first state actually to pass a law called Extended Producer Responsibility, or EPR. And what that is it means that if a manufacturer is going to send packaging into Maine that is not recyclable, they're going to have to pay a fee. And this is actually going to start in 2026. We passed the law and the rules have been made and we're getting ready to sort of launch this thing. So I think that, you know, and the reason why, in a way, that's such a big issue is because Maine, as many people, probably many of your listeners know, is a really beautiful, fairly pristine state. I mean, people come here on vacation because they want to look at the beautiful coastline. They want to climb the mountains. They want to swim in the clean lakes and all of that. And so we in Maine want to keep it that way. And being deluged with, you know, toxic chemicals and over-packaging is just something we don't want. And so we're kind of leading the way on those issues. That's what I would say is kind of the high, you know, attention-getting issues right now are those.
Well, it is absolutely beautiful there. And I can't imagine changing it.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
I have quite a few stories that are not tellable on radio that jump to mind, and should have a whole different podcast just on things I'm not allowed to talk about. So,
oh, there we go.
Yeah. So, all right, back to the book. What else can we do? Do these local small efforts, you know, can collection in front of the Kroger or the local grocery store, do these things make a dent?
Absolutely, they do. I mean, that's the thing, is there is power in what we do. And of course, there's a lot more power in joining a group than trying to do something individually. You know, it's sort of been shown that individually we can easily get overwhelmed by sort of the scope of things. But if you can join a group, you know, whether that's in your homeowners association or maybe it's in your town, you know, here we have strong towns and people do things like, you know, launch, you know, plastic bag bans for their town or pesticide bans for their town. So joining a group is really the way to actually make a difference. And so I always say that's the first thing is, you know, find a group of people that have sort of the same views that you do, and together you can do great things. So that's kind of number one is, you know, find your people. And then, you know, and we've seen a lot of, you know, protests and things like that, you know, during the last 9 months, as people are unhappy with some of the policies coming out of Washington. So, but that's where the power is the power is in doing, in joining the groups and acting as a group.
All right. You know, one of the things that I would say about the environment and the environmental issue and the cause, the advocates, is it seems to me that if I don't agree with you 100%, that you're not willing to talk to me about my ideas on nuclear. You know, I'm a pretty big advocate for nuclear. I think it's we need to reconsider it as part of our mix. And, and I am insulted when I am left out because of that one issue. Does that make sense?
That makes sense. And it kind of makes me sad actually, because, you know,
there's a lot of people who feel like me left out because of the exclusionary practices of the movement. Okay. I'll stop.
It's sad, and it's also, you know, we're in a time where, you know, no one can know everything, right? I mean, there's just so much going on. We can't all be experts, right? So I think it's really important to listen to people who have knowledge, you know, that maybe I don't have, or maybe you don't have. I mean, I think, you know, I feel sorry to hear that. And I actually, you know, I do a Substack blog. I post every other week, and the way I do it is I actually go and do research, right? So that what I'm trying to do is say, you know, here's an issue and here's some of the background on that so that, you know, people can actually start to understand things. And I think, you know, absolutely environmentalists should listen to people who know about nuclear, right? I mean, you probably know more than I do about that. So I'd be interested in learning. So I think it's that. It's the attitude of learning from each other that we need to cultivate. Because like I say, it's too big. You can't be a fisheries expert and a forestries expert and a nuclear expert. You know, you can't know every issue in depth. So you've got to rely on other people who have looked into it. So yeah, sorry to hear that, but I think, you know, there are a lot of reasonable advocates out there. I consider myself one of those. I love studying issues, but I can't know them all. I know that. So, you know, I do what I can and then I listen to others.
You seem 100% reasonable and willing to listen to my ideas. So, when my latest book came out, this is the first book I've written on the environment. 3 or 4 people reached out to me and said, "You're going to be in trouble. You should just not do this." And, and having reached out to 1,000 radio shows and podcasts to ask to be on their show, there's a distinct bias toward who wants to hear my message and who has no interest in it whatsoever, which I find is very sad.
Yeah, that is actually. Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, think we should cultivate curiosity for one thing, you know, we're not curious enough, you know, and I mean, that's what I love about writing my blog posts is that I'll get curious about something and I'll go check it out. And then what I find, I write. So I find that to be really fun, really interesting. I just wrote a post on the UN climate negotiations coming up November 10th. And just as a great example, because I always thought of the climate negotiations as being the most dry, boring, uneventful things ever, right? You know, like they've been talking about climate negotiations since 1995 without really showing that they've really accomplished much of anything. And so I thought, well, okay, I wonder if they could accomplish anything this year. And I went and looked it up, and there's some new things that are going to influence this year's climate negotiations. And I think there's a really good chance they're going to actually move something forward. They actually might move the ball forward this year, which, you know, so anyway,
doing what could you hope for?
I'll tell you what for is the International Court of Justice at The Hague in the Netherlands made a decision in July. And the decision was that countries that are responsible for climate change are also to be responsible for paying for the damage in countries that can't afford to pay for that. So, you know, this was a case brought by the Pacific Islands that are basically getting flooded out. And so,
what side of the equation is China there?
Well, China, that's another whole thing that's going to be really interesting this year is China for the first time has pledged to reduce their climate emissions like they never had done this before. And so they're going to go to these negotiations in Brazil and make a big announcement. They've actually told us what it is already, but they're going to, you know, formally announce that they're going to reduce their climate emissions between 7% and 10% by 2030. And, you know, that might not sound like a lot, but the thing to know about China is that they don't, when they make a pledge, they're what they try to do is make a really low estimate and then outperform it. And they've done this in all kinds of other ways. And so I expect that, you know, once they make this pledge, then they're going to go and outperform it. And what they're looking to do, whether you like this or not, and I know there's lots of people on different sides here, but China is trying to take the lead in renewable energy by doing this. So they want to own that industry. And so they've decided, well, if we go and make a pledge at the negotiations in Brazil, that'll put us on the map and we will be, you know, basically become the leaders in renewable energy. So again, that's another one of these things that I think this year's negotiations will not be as boring and lifeless as some of the past ones, because there's some actual changes that'll probably happen.
Well, I would love to see that. I am one of the people that believe China just lies about almost all of its data. And so I'm just not a believer in the data from China. And if you really want, Sue, something to explore and to study, go and study the Chinese population. There is amazing data out there. You know, things that are just really hard to refute, cell phone usage, salt consumption, things like that, that indicate that the population is hundreds of millions less than they are claiming. And
really?
Not just 100 or 200, like 600 or 700 million less than they're claiming. And the data, again, so is really hard to refute. And salt, it was my favorite one. If a country is using XXX salt, and all of a sudden it's using X/2 salt, you know, what happened? And it's not all of a sudden everyone got healthy, you know?
So the question that you're raising, though, is why would they want to underestimate their population?
I mean, I have no clue.
Or overestimate. Right. Why would they want to do that?
Bragging rights. They love to brag about the biggest, the best, the fanciest, the newest. And I think they got caught with their pants down that they really didn't know what it was. And then they found out that it was probably overestimated quite a bit. And then the COVID hit. And the, you know, the mortuary data there, the, you know, the number of coffins ordered, just all of that data points to they lost several hundred million people because of COVID. And so anyway, if you want to go on a rabbit hole one day, that's a fun one.
I bet it is. Yeah.
It's a fun one. Oh, there's really good evidence and stuff. So anyway,
that's fascinating. I mean, I will say that the data point that I do believe is, they made a pledge to, deliver a certain number of solar arrays by a certain date. And I don't know the exact numbers, but anyway, they made a goal for 2030 and they met that goal in 2024, 6 years earlier. So I have no reason to not believe that. I think it's probably true, but I think that's really interesting what you're saying. So yeah.
Fascinating. And Sue, I love you because of your ability to hear a crazy theory and go, that's interesting. Instead of going, yeah, well, you're a moron. Look at the way you're dressed, you know. And so I just like having fun intellectual conversations with smart people who agree and disagree with me. And as long as we can stay respectful like you've been, I think it's a lot of fun. So
yeah,
I love learning how to help with the environment. And it comes down to all acting local, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it really does. In fact, if I have a second, I'd love to say something about that because because one of the things that really struck me about a year ago in the election last year, when Trump was elected president, actually, there were 13 referendums across the country that were environmental. And these were in blue states, red states, I mean, across the country, and 13 referendums. And all of them, they're all environmental. All of them passed, and they all passed with over 60% of the vote. And when I saw that, I realized something that, you know, I hadn't really seen it so clearly before. And what it is that people love their place. They love their home. It's whether it's a lake, a river, a mountain, the coast, whatever it is, they're going to do anything to protect it. All of these referendums were to protect local features of the environment. And so that just gave me huge hope, right? Because, you know, people are going to fight for their, where they live, for the things they love. It's not partisan. You know, it's just sort of a gut thing. We're all connected to the land where we are, and we don't want it to, you know, be trashed, right? So I just found that just the most hopeful thing. And I mean, there's a lot of things to be upset about these days, but people just love their place. And that, so to your point, you know, that's what people need to do. They need to figure out what it is they love about their place and then defend it for all they're worth. And that's the kind of the bottom line. You know, what's in your place that you love, that you want to take care of, that you want to see preserved. So, you know, and people are doing that. And I think more people need to do that. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, I have a passion around that one, as you can tell.
How do we get in touch, follow you online, visit you on the net?
I'd love to promote that. So I started writing a newsletter to promote my book, Advocating for the Environment. And then somehow or other, it took off and became a thing of its own with new content every other week. So I do a Substack post. You can find it by going to Substack and looking me up, Susan B. Inches. You can also go to my website at www.sueinches.com, and you can sign up for my newsletter there. I do other things too. I do consulting work. I do writing. I do some workshops and things. So, you know, you can engage with me in a lot of different ways. But at the very least, I'd say, you know, check out my blog, because, you know, if you only have a couple of minutes, I can give you, an idea or an overview of an issue very quickly without having to read very much. You can understand, you know, what's going on. So I hope people will check it out.
Sue, thank you so much for being with us, and congratulations on the book.
Well, thanks for the interview. I really appreciate it. It's been great talking to you.
Likewise. We're out of time. Have a great day, everyone. Bye now.